It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello.
So is that like the special theme music that you commissioned for the war? You know, the music that we have. We have the little graphic down in front, you know, Battle for Freedom or something.
Yeah, we actually spent a lot of money on having that made just for this occasion. So, all right, well, week two of our attack on Iraq. Plenty of media coverage, but not a lot of facts to be found.
Well, there's plenty of facts to be found in terms of media coverage of the war, and we should acknowledge there's other things going on in the world, too, and with any luck, we'll have time to get to them. Some other week, maybe, if not this, but there's plenty of facts to be found. You just can't necessarily find them in U.S. media, or if you can, they're usually watered down and or they're a day late or a dollar short. It was interesting that the first segment of Counterspin had one of the media editor, I think it was for the Guardian in the U.K. If you look at the Times and the PI this morning, the Seattle Times and the PI, and you look at the Guardian's website for its lead four stories, all of which concern the Iraq war. And again, as with most days, and this is why folks should be checking out the foreign press and alternative U.S. media as well, it's like a different universe. You had four lead stories on the Guardian's website this morning, all of which regarding the war, all of which regarding the war not going particularly well in terms of the U.S.-U.K. forces. Let's stop calling it a coalition, shall we? And only one of them, that is the market bombing, was on either of the front pages of the Times or the PI. It only made it onto the PI, and that was the Iraq claimed dozens killed. It was 58, I believe, and it was not listed in the Guardian as UK. You've also had Donald Rumsfeld threatening Syria, which didn't make it into the headlines here. And Syria, like most Arab and Muslim countries, is you know, people in and arms are going into Iraq at this
right.
point.
Here, the Syria story was in the Post Intelligencer, but it was in deep inside and it was Rumsfeld warns Syria.
Yeah, and the same thing is true with the Times for some of these stories. It's buried inside, but you have to look. And you had also the suicide bombing being a lead story, and then you had also that the attack on Baghdad is quote unquote on hold. And obviously, it's on hold. It's going to be a long way away at this point. You know, we've had this trajectory over the last 9 days now of the initially everything was going swimmingly, and then, you know, it being a desert, of course, the water turned out to be a mirage, and you came into the pockets of resistance, and then pockets of heavy resistance, and now it turns out that many of these soldiers are in dogfights, and strategically it just seems to be setting up to be a disaster.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the military strategy. It was Rumsfeld's plan, and Paul Wolfowitz has helped him draw it up. And there's a number of people on the Pentagon Advisory Board, including Richard Perle, Newt Gingrich, Henry Kissinger, who added their two cents to help shape this plan of a small ground force moving very, very rapidly towards Baghdad, supported by air power.
Yes, and a millisecond of silence for Richard Perle, please.
Who is now out of a job.
Yes. Well, one of his jobs, anyway.
Yeah. But this plan was hotly contested by a lot of Pentagon planners, men who are military men who have fought in wars, who also have been part of invasion plans in the first Gulf War, and also by Colin Powell, who had pushed for a much, much, much larger ground force to go into Iraq, what's called the overwhelming force option. Right now, they had said that we should have a force of up to 500,000 troops, which is about what we had during the Gulf War. Right now, there are 90,000 troops in Iraq, U.S. forces, and I believe combined U.S.-British forces. And the frontline U.S. forces number somewhere, we're not exactly sure because of U.S. secrecy, but it numbers somewhere between 30,000 and 75,000 troops. Now, we've got you've got troops at Basra, those are mostly British troops, troops at An-Nasiriya, at Najaf, at villages along the long extended supply line who are trying to protect that supply line. You have troops guarding oil wells that are burning, and a lot of those troops have been pulled from the front line that's pushing towards Baghdad, but which is now stalled. Now, I want to talk in particular about the long supply line and about a certain bottleneck along the supply line, and that is at En Nasiriyah. Now, I've been reading reports in the press about troops at the front towards Karbala and Al-Qut. Marines are at Al-Qut on the eastern side, and there are army troops at Karbala that are engaged in a firefight that are closer to Baghdad. But the long supply line has been cut off by all of these cities that we've left along the route that are full of Iraqi military and Iraqi paramilitary forces, the Fedayeen Saddam groups that fight in black clothing or are in civilian clothing. Now, these guys come out of the cities at night and they attack the supply route. There are long stretches of the supply route that cross bare desert or ridges or are in isolated areas where U.S. troops cannot protect them, and they're being attacked by these paramilitary forces. Now, there's one particular bottleneck along the supply route, and I've been reading in papers that the frontline troops have been going without food and water on two meals a day, that they're running out of fuel. Now, the M1A2 Abrams tank needs about 2 gallons of gas to go 1 mile. So that shows you why the U.S. needs fuel very, very desperately along that supply route.
Shows you why we're in Iraq, actually.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It's very ironic. But they're also running out of ammunition, too. And when your frontline troops run out of fuel and out of bullets, you're in serious trouble. And it brings up the specter of U.S. troops having to eventually abandon their tanks and march back down the supply line to safer areas, and all the while being under attack by paramilitary forces. That's a nightmare scenario that the Pentagon must be just sweating over at this moment. One of the major problems is at En Nasiriyah, which is the biggest bottleneck along the supply route. What you have there is a situation where you have a city of 500,000 people. You have Iraqi military emplacements outside that city, artillery people, Iraqi troops using grenade launchers and machine guns. They overlook a portion of the road that goes up over a bridge, along a ridge, and then for a few miles, and then over another bridge. And all the time that U.S. tanks and armored units and supply trucks are along that ridge between those two bridges, they are under heavy fire from Iraqi military. And it's been called by Marines and Army troops, U.S. Marines and Army troops, a turkey shoot with U.S. troops the target. That's how bad it is. And now it has severely hampered the ability. I mean, armored units like tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles can get through there, particularly when they have helicopter support to hold back some of the Iraqi artillery fire. But when it comes to troop convoys and to supply trucks, it's been much, much, much harder for them to get through En Nasiriyah. And that's why it's being said by U.S. media and military that some of the hottest fighting of the war has gone on there. In fact, that place has been the choke point for the supply line.
Well, it begs the question of why isn't the U.S. taking out this artillery fire?
Well, there's a problem at En Nasiriyah. The artillery is in place right in the outskirts of the city. Some of it is in the city center, and we have a policy of a spoken policy, and this is something that's being hotly contested right now in the Pentagon, of not bombing the civilian targets or targets that are close to civilian areas. And so there are troops in the field who would like to take out those gun emplacements, but they can't do it without hitting the civilians, the 500,000 people who live in En Nasiriyah. Now, what we're going to see probably in the next week or two is we're going to see a shift. I believe this. We're going to see a shift in the U.S. military's plans to actually begin bombing not just En Nasiriyah heavily, but Baghdad and Basra and all of the smaller villages, places like Najaf, Karbala, a lot of the much smaller towns along the supply route, in order to take out these paramilitary forces, these gun emplacements, guys with machine guns and grenade launchers who have been sniping at the U.S. supply route. And that's going to change the war from one that isn't targeting civilians or isn't endangering civilians as much to one that's going to be endangering them quite a bit. So we're going to be seeing a lot more heavy bombing in the cities, I think.
Yeah, we've seen, and certainly people who've been on the internet have seen this, there have been a number of reports coming out of places like Baghdad of, you know, bombing raids and so forth, but we have not seen the initial shock and awe and heavy casualties and bombing that certainly the peace movement was fearing and many of the opponents of war were fearing. But, you know, when you get into a point where the soldiers, you know, where the Pentagon is worried about having its butt handed to it, that I think also will go by the wayside. But there's a couple of problems here. Number one is that, you know, it's almost like the Revolutionary War where the you know, the British were complaining that the redcoats were out here in plain sight and the Americans were fighting unfairly and it was their land and they knew the terrain. The Iraqis know the terrain here. They've been worried about defending this terrain first against in the war with Iran and then with the Gulf War. I mean, it's been a 20-year process.
We've been hearing about the armored column coming south out of Baghdad, tons of tanks and armored vehicles and Republican Guard troops to meet U.S. soldiers at Karbala. And we've been reassured by the Pentagon that U.S. airplanes and British planes have been bombing the crap out of these guys and are going to decimate them before they reach the front line. But the problem is that U.S. planes are returning to their carriers without dropping their bombs, and there's a reason for that. These armored divisions know all the hiding places. They're moving from one hiding place to another. These guys have trained for decades in how to defend Baghdad. It's their territory. And the armored column is not moving as a unit. They are moving in smaller groups, and they are holding to places where it is almost impossible for the U.S. fighter bombers to reach them. And so they're not having much effect on these Republican Guard troops. And I think the Pentagon is looking at this armored column moving south towards U.S. troops who are running out of supplies, who are exhausted after a week of nonstop fighting with no sleep. And they're saying, my God, we're losing this war.
Yeah,
we're going to have to change our strategy.
And, you know, there's a couple broader things that are going on here, too. Number one is that the longer it takes for, you know, you're not having the immediate sweeping victory that U.S. officials, particularly the politicians as opposed to the military people, were very arrogantly, I think, predicting. The longer that that Iraqis hold on, quote unquote, number one, the more that they believe, the more confidence that they can get that the United States is not and the UK are not invincible, the more that there is time for support to come in from other Islamic countries. And you know, beyond that, you've got this whole interruption.
The longer it takes, too, the less likely the Shiites are going to rise up.
Yes.
Because they are remembering how the U.S. sold them out during the Gulf War. And if we can't have at least one good, strong victory somewhere in Iraq, we've been avoiding major battles going around these cities and just opting for small firefights and killing a few snipers here and there. The longer it takes for the U.S. to have even one major victory in Iraq, the less likely the Shiites are going to help us out.
Yeah. And the ultimate piece of this is that the whole narrative that the United States and the UK are going to go sweeping in and they'd be welcomed as liberators by the Iraqi people, that it would be like V-Day in Paris, there'd be a ticker tape parade and all the rest of this. There's a very black and white thinking that people hate Saddam and therefore they love the United States. We've already seen that that's not going to happen. So no matter how a U.S.-UK military victory happens, and at this point you have to say if rather than when or, you know, but assuming even that it does, you've still got an occupation. You've still got to deal with ongoing resistance. You've still got to deal with people that want the West out of Iraq. And that's going to keep happening until the United States figures out that it needs to withdraw.
Yeah, and looking at some of the interviews with British soldiers in the British press, they're starting to say things like they're encamped around Basra searching civilians coming and going from the city, and they're saying it's starting to look a lot like Northern Ireland, like a long, brutal, bloody occupation.
Well, and watching coverage of BBC and CBC, they're doing interviews with former Iraqis who came to Jordan, you know, to get work there, and these people are going back to Iraq in droves, saying that, you know, they're very angry about the U.S. coming in, and they're going back, even though they didn't like Saddam, they're going back to take up arms against the U.S., you know, and they have all these refugee camps there in Jordan
and we're
that
not
are absolutely empty.
Right, and we're not talking about a few hundred guys. There are something like 300,000 Iraqis that work in Jordan.
Yeah, and that's and it's not just happening in Jordan. It's happening all over the Middle East. And it's also happening with non-Iraqis, other Arab contingents, other contingents from other Muslim countries that are starting to make their way back into Iraq. That was one of the things that Rumsfeld was complaining about in terms of what's coming in from Syria right now. Arms and weaponry are starting to come in. People are starting to come in. And the entire Arab and Muslim world is just incensed, number one, incensed by this invasion, and number two, starting to believe and very much believing that the United States and Britain can be pushed back. And if the United States starts bombing and taking out civilian populations, which I agree with Maria, I think that's fairly likely, that's throwing even more gasoline on that fire.
And it's already, I think, started to begin. At An-Nasiriyah, they bombed the heck out of it. I think it was last night or the night before. They've taken out the electricity supply to the city, and 500,000 people are pretty soon going to be without water, food, and any way to any medical care and any way to take care of themselves.
Yeah, there are actually humanitarian crises, and that's sort of sort of the euphemism for no food, no water, and you know, hundreds of thousands of people starting to pop up all over southern Iraq. And that's something else that the United States is going to have to bear responsibility for. They're trying to talk the United Nations into picking up some of the cost for that at the same time that they're insisting that the UN should have no role in an occupation, which is what many European countries would like to see. And, you know, that too is shaping up to be a real mess. I mean, we're starting to see the scope, and it's I really fear this. It's just going to get wider and wider. We're starting to see unfold the scope of George Bush's folly.
Well, in addition to Donald Rumsfeld threatening Syria and Iran this week, I understand there was some pressure applied to Turkey.
Well, no, the pressure applied to Turkey was actually before the war, but there have been some interesting tidbits floating out, again, also mostly in the international press, about why you had this this reversal. If folks remember in the last couple of weeks before the invasion started, where the Turkish parliament reversed itself in terms of permitting U.S. land forces to come through Turkey and invade from the north, and you also had the Turkish military defying United States wishes, starting to go into Kurdish territory. They've pulled back and are literally massed on the border right now, waiting for the opportunity to go in, and the Kurds are terrified of this. A couple of interesting things have come out. Number one is that much of what, I shouldn't say much, but certainly a major factor in stiffening civilian resistance in the civilian government of Turkey was the State Department in the Bush administration saying, look, you sign off on this or we can get the military to sign off for you. Meaning basically a threat. You had a background where there is a new Islamist oriented civilian government that was elected in Turkey a few months ago. The last time that type of a coalition government took power in Turkey, I think about 5 years or so ago, there was a military coup. That military coup was supported by the United States. So what that was interpreted as a not very veiled threat by the civilian government in Turkey, that the United States is saying, you know, to a NATO ally, to somebody that's considered, you know, an essential ally, the secular moderate, you know, Muslim democracy in the Middle East, that you sign off on this war with us or we'll have our military overthrow you with a military coup d'etat. Not surprisingly, Turkey resented that quite a bit. Not only that, but it also upset the Turkish armed forces, and so they're less inclined to go along with the United States wishes. And you had fairly delicate, long-standing negotiations that, according to a couple people I've talked to in D.C., were on the verge of bearing fruit, where the United Nations was going to finally have a peace broker between Greece and Turkey over the divided island of Cyprus. That's a standoff that's been going on for nearly 30 years, and that also has fallen apart because of this invasion of Iraq. So you see all of these little diplomatic straws, the various cards that fall down in order because of the ham-fistedness of the Bush administration, because it's been so insistent on trying to wage this war, and all of the little sort of diplomatic collateral damage, as it were, that can have just huge impacts on people's lives and the political futures of places that we don't necessarily think of as being directly associated with Iraq.
Well, one of those places was actually, to my understanding, downtown Seattle during the last week, during the protests.
Yes.
Speaking of military coups, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was there on Thursday night, actually, as well as Saturday, to watch the Seattle Police Department use extremely heavy-handed tactics against peaceful demonstrators. It was as if they were responding to a terrorist attack and not to a few people trying to exercise their free speech rights. I think this boils down to the fact that that Gil Kerlikowske would like to have control and wants to use military-style tactics against a civilian population, much the same way we're doing that over in Iraq right now. But what I saw on Saturday...
I wouldn't push that comparison too far, but yeah.
But yeah, no, I think there is some extension there. I mean, the Bush administration wants to bully civilian populations to get them to do what we want, and Gil Kerlikowske wants to use military-style tactics in order to get demonstrators to do what he wants and not to do what we're allowed by the Constitution. On Saturday, it was particularly bad. You saw a police cordon around about an 8-to-10 block radius around the federal building to try to corral demonstrators and to keep them from moving legally on the sidewalks. People were on the sidewalks. They were crossing with the lights. They were not jaywalking. But they were blocked by police from going where they should be allowed to go legally anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, and in both cases, Iraq and the sidewalks of Seattle, the word unprovoked comes to mind because,
yes,
again, there was no reason for this demonstration to be literally attacked by police, and not just the demonstrators, but also bystanders. It shouldn't make a difference, of course. People have a right to have their political opinions and express them wherever they want to legally.
I wasn't actually in the demonstration myself. In fact, I couldn't march because my knee's been bothering me, but I was trying to escape the police cordon so that I could go home and rest. I've been working a lot lately. And I saw a number of bystanders, people who were office workers, shoppers, parents with their kids, just trying to get a half a block past the police cordon to get into the bus tunnel to get out of downtown Seattle. And they were denied that ability.
Yeah.
They were corralled. A lot of them were corralled with the demonstrators into small areas, and some of them were, I believe, arrested as well.
Yeah, you really had, I think, a conscious decision. I don't even know if it came from Kerlikowske.
I think he was there directing what the police were doing that day on Saturday.
Let me finish. I think it may have come from the city hall, and Kerlikowske may have been, or certainly with. The mayor's office signing off on it. I think there was a conscious attempt by the city to send out a message that they did not want people demonstrating in downtown Seattle when the war started. And it wasn't so much that they wanted to crack down on the demonstrators who were there. They wanted to scare other people away from demonstrating.
They were pretty successful.
And they were very successful. You know, moms with babies and strollers, you know, the kind of people who have been coming out, you know, older folks, churchgoers, you know, middle class folks who don't normally come to demonstrations. Those are the people who have been going to the peace demonstrations for the last 6 months in Seattle. Very successful, peaceful, enormous demonstrations with less violence than you would find after your average Seahawks or Mariners game. And the city made a conscious decision that they didn't want those kind of turnouts, and they wanted to scare those folks away, and they did.
And this would have been the first time that those people would have come down to a demonstration and seen the police in full riot gear carrying weapons to fire tear gas canisters and rubber bullets, and that's why they stayed away, I am convinced.
Yeah.
Well, and according to a citizen testimony at a hearing that Nick Licata had earlier this week, there was, and I don't know, you can tell us if Saturday, if it was just SPD, or because on several of these days there was King County Sheriff.
Well, Saturday,
Saturday
I saw SPD and King County Sheriff. I also saw Redmond Police there as well. I saw a Redmond police car, and I understand that later in the day, there were people coming from out. There were cops coming from outlying areas like Kent and Tukwila and Issaquah and places like that.
Yeah, I saw the outlying as well as city and county on both Thursday and Friday, and I also saw state patrol on both days.
There was numerous citizens that testified as to the King County Sheriffs having automatic weapons with them that were drawn, and it sounded like a lot of these forces were being, as you were alluding to, Jav, that the commands were coming from somewhere other than just Kerlikowske, that it might have been coming from more of a federal level leading all
that
these guys.
Is a possibility as well, that the feds told local police departments in major cities that you need to clamp down on protests because we can't have... and they might have used the excuse of the threat of terrorist attack, but I think it was mostly to shape people's opinions on the war.
Right. Yeah, and that's speculation at this point. I think that one of the major questions, though, is how do folks respond? And it really, to me, underscores the idea that public, visible opposition to this war, and it's going to need to continue as this war unfolds as more and more of a bad idea. The peace movement is going to have to be able to come out with clear alternatives, is going to have to look forward as well as just, you know, already mourning what has happened and what is unfolding. And similar to the blossoming of the neighborhood groups over the last 6 months, we're going to have to start coming up with different tactics. We're going to have to start coming up with different ways to maintain a public presence, a presence that has an alternative, a presence that is a safe space for people other than progressive activists or other than street demonstrators who don't mind tangling with the cops. We have to figure out a way to communicate to the public and with the public, not just that this war is a bad idea, but where we go from here. And not only where do we go from here in terms of what's unfolding in Iraq, but starting to organize to make sure that this can't happen in the future. And that includes a presidential election coming up next year. We got to start thinking about getting these guys out of office, too.
And right now, this past week has proved that it is possible to get rid of George Bush. Just the incredibly poor war strategy that we've seen so far should be enough to kick him out of office.
Well, and one of the key things about the communicating both ideas to people is that there's also a component of listening to others, which
yes.
Doesn't seem to be a real strength in a lot of the situations I've been viewing. So,
we need to find a way to be able to communicate people where we don't polarize the discussion.
So, something everybody needs to work on. Well, we still have a couple minutes left talking with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchek, co-editors at Eat the State. Any last subject matter you want to throw our
way
in a minute and a half?
Sure. Well, I want to throw in a couple of very quick things. One is just to flag people to notice that there have been, because of the unfolding of this war and the diversion of the world's attention, crackdowns on dissidents in a number of other countries around the world, Zimbabwe, Burma, otherwise known as Myanmar.
And, all across the Middle East.
Yeah, all across the Middle East and in Cuba. And there's this whole narrative in Cuba that there really isn't time to go into right now about the Bush administration appointee in Havana going around over the past several months and making a very public show of meeting with critics of the Castro regime there in a really unprecedentedly provocative way. And the Castro regime is now arresting many of the people that the Bush folks have met with. So that's unfolding. And then I just want to put in a plug for reading foreign media, reading alternative media, getting your news from places other than the TV, and the current issue of Eat the State has a full page of listings of alternative sources, both international media, media from the Middle East, media from independent sources in the United States, and locally as well, that I think might be very helpful for some folks.
Well, speaking of which, how about telling us where people can find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, restaurants, even in the public library, places where you pick up free periodicals. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate, all one word, that's eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to volunteer, you can give our message line a call at 206-903-9461.
And we just want to point out that not all the periodicals in the public library are free.
That's true. They're free if you have a library card.
Yes, and for a certain number of time. Yeah, right. After that, it starts to add up. Yep.
Uh-huh. Okay.